This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. On the program today, since this is Reporters Roundtable Thursday, we take a look at some of the major stories that you've been able to see and check out online as well as in print this week. With us, we'll have Ed Bierschenk, who covers a lot of news involving the city of Hammond for the Times of Northwest Indiana. Northwest Indiana Times business reporter Joseph Pete will join us as well. And we'll have Meredith Colias, who covers education topics and the like for the Post Tribune. A wide range of stories we'll cover today on Reporters Roundtable Thursday. On this Regionally Speaking Reporter Roundtable Thursday, let's take a look first at news up in North Lake County. In particular, here we have with us Ed Bierschenk, who covers stories mainly in Hammond, but also occasionally in Gary and other places up north for the Times of Northwest Indiana. As always, Ed, thank you for joining us today.
Glad to be there. Thanks. Well,
let's take a look first here at one of the big stories in Hammond, actually it's East Chicago, with some reaction in Hammond as well, too. We're talking about the explosion that happened inside the post office building in East Chicago. If you will, give us a little background on what happened there and about the investigation. And going along with that, the story that you followed up on later, a conversation you had with Hammond Mayor Tom McDermott Jr.
Sure. There was the early September, a postal employee at the post office was injured, not extensively, minor injuries, with a package that was at the post office and determined to be a pipe bomb, and they weren't able to determine exactly where it came from right away. From what I understand in the conversations with the mayor, it wasn't until later that there was a threatening letter sent to an employee at the city hall, kind of a bulky letter. And at that time, it was determined that the pipe bomb and the letter were related. And they also were able to determine that the package that exploded in the post office was actually intended to go to a person who does some work for the city under a contract basis.
Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds like it's, I don't know if it's maybe a personal problem or some kind of complaint. Maybe if it sounds like it's some type of employee that even working for a contract for the city of Hammond, they may have had some kind of disagreement or a feud or some kind of something happened. We know they do, the people, you know, have regular contact with government employees, and sometimes the business doesn't turn out as way as they'd like it. And so there's a few little fights and disagreements that can come about of that, too, I know. So I'm sure that maybe that has something to do with all this.
Right. I think they're still trying to, you know, they didn't want to release too many details. I know they talked to the mayor for a couple hours, but as he was saying, you know, they're still trying to determine exactly why this was done. But, yeah, they deal with a lot of different issues. A lot of times, you know, they can deal with anything from having it, you know, in some cases take people's homes or condemn a home, do all types of things. They haven't released exactly why they think this happened.
Like, could be some zoning issues, some permit or something like that didn't happen, that somebody's not happy about. It's hard to say.
Oh, sure.
What I found was interesting about the second story here that you had in talking with Mayor McDermott was how Hammond City Hall seems to be reacting, I guess, physically as well as the people on the staff to what has been happening, even though the incident actually kind of happened in East Chicago.
Yeah, it happened in East Chicago, although the second letter, I think, went ahead and was delivered, actually, at City Hall.
Yeah.
And so he sent out information to, he notified all the employees to be on the lookout, and then he also sent out messages to the council people to be on the lookout for any suspicious letters or packages and to alert police right away. And I think what's happened to the mayor mentioned he noticed it when he pulled into his driveway. There's some additional police presence, kind of watching out for some of the people that may be threatened.
probably just as a precaution, is probably a wise idea too. It's you just never know. I know. I like the comment that you had in your story here about the hate to think that it's a kind of a jaded feeling about the what happens these days, but he seemed to think that this is what we have to put up with now, I suppose.
Yeah, I think, you know, we've seen unfortunately some even major events where, you know, a lot of people have been hurt in government and outside of government from people that just gone crazy for some reason. And, you know, he said it's, I think with the other thing he talked about, just trying to explain it to, you know, your son or your young boy. And then he said, you know, I not only had to explain it to my son, but then all the employees, I had to tell them, and then they had to tell their wives and families about this as well, that something like this could happen. So, yeah, it can be stressful. And I imagine, you know, if you're working for a company that works for the city, that can even extend that out that way. So it affects a lot of people.
One of the other stories that you had a chance to talk and or read in, and we had a chance to read and you had the chance to go into more detail about was some action that was taken at the city council in preparation for the 2018 budget and some opportunities that some city employees in Hammond can take advantage of if they're eligible to take early retirement. Tell us about that.
Yeah, you know, as we're getting closer to, I think, the additional tax caps that are going to be taking place in the city, and the city expects to see their property tax levels start to decline. They've been trying to cut back on the number of employees. I think the other reason for this, too, is they want to try to do some shifting of employees with the upcoming court closure that's happening in about a year or two. So I know Mayor McDermott, one of the things he said he wanted to try to do was try to avoid a lot of too many layoffs in the city clerk and in the courts. So if there's some areas where maybe he can transfer people to some open positions within the city, he would like to do that as well. Now, he was saying, you know, with this latest one, he's going to go ahead and not replace positions as much as possible, except in vital areas. But even if they do replace people, there is those savings from, you know, the people don't have as much experience. They're probably not going to get as paid as much money. They're also not going to have accrued benefits. So maybe someone who had 4 or 5 weeks of vacation built up and the city had to find someone to fill in when they were on vacation, they maybe don't have to do that anymore.
Yeah.
So there's cost savings in that as well.
I would imagine, too, that this opportunity comes up here when these things happen. You take early retirement, obviously, it would be a benefit for somebody who had been thinking about it anyway, but to have to do it is another story.
Right.
And also, too, I would imagine, too, this would be an opportunity for people that they're in certain positions in City Hall, in departments, that if they had always wanted to do something else and they felt they might be qualified or at least they might be able to be trained to go into another position, that might give them a chance to kind of shift their job around.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think they can do this. Although I think I think the city council has been trying to tell some of the employees too that hey, you know, we did this 2 years ago. We did it now, but don't count on holding off for 2 years and you know that we might do it again because we might not have the money in 2 years to do it.
And the opportunity doesn't happen every year, or it isn't certainly going to happen every 2 years to be able to take early retirement like this. So, you're talking earlier here in the motive behind making the early retirement program available was to be ready for the property tax caps. One of the stories that you have out there talks about the property tax increase, tax rate rather, that's going to increase slightly in the city of Hammond. Tell us about that.
It looks like maybe I think 2%, not much at all. And I think what they're thinking is because of what we have in effect right now, that for most people, they're not, and homeowners, they're not really going to see much of an increase at all. The budget, I think, is going to be pretty much what it was this year. In the coming year, they do have some increases in the park department budget because they're going to have to take care of a bunch of trees they have to get rid of, unfortunately, and also they're getting prepared for the Sportsplex and Community Center, which should open in fall of 2018.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
And so they're getting they're putting money aside for utilities and for the employees that they're going to have there. Now, hopefully, they'll get enough revenue that will come in that will take care of that additional expenditures, and that's their hope. And as well as, you know, just bringing business into the area in general, that's one of their big, I think, hopes that they have as well.
Yeah, we're talking with Ed Bearshank with the Times of Northwest Indiana. He covers news in Hammond for the Times that you get to read in print and online. And talking too about the budget coming up for 2018, I know that salary increases are built in, at least for city employees and elected officials. But the question I know that comes up, and it's in the story that you put out, talks about whether the council members themselves might be able to pick up a raise in the deal.
Yeah, I think they're pretty well. From the council people I've talked to, council president and other council members, I think they'll go ahead and decide they'll take the same increase of the 2% increase that are given to employees, and that will probably go ahead and they'll do the same for the mayor and any other elected officials. Will probably get that same increase. That seems like that's been kind of the standard practice for the last few years there.
One of the other stories, too, because we're kind of finishing up here talking about what's happening in the city of Hammond lately, is that the City Redevelopment Commission is going to take on another building in the historic downtown district. Tell us about that.
Yeah, actually, I guess it's the old Straub building, and it's pretty basically empty, and it's not too far away, almost directly across the street from the Hotel LaSalle that they're also trying to close on. So they're trying to get control of some of these buildings, and I think it gives them control of what type of business is going to go in there. We had the other one that they acquired was JCPenney. Of course, that one got torn down.
Yeah, that's parking now.
Yeah. But I think with the Hotel LaSalle, they're hoping to be able to go ahead and, use it for some other purposes. They don't want to make a hotel out of it, although the chamber and another businessman from downtown said he wouldn't mind to see some type of boutique hotel built there, but that doesn't seem likely. One of the main things when they got the building was they also got a liquor license, which is kind of interesting, which might, they're hoping that they can use that to attract a restaurant either into that building, or from what they're telling me, they can use that license at other locations. So, for instance, the LaSalle Hotel has a restaurant facility built into it, and perhaps they can use that to attract a restaurant operator there.
When you talk about redevelopment, I guess that would give the city an opportunity to attract some new tenant or tenants, I suppose, to the Straub building, since it's vacant, and it would be easy to get the work done to make it fit whatever purpose that might be out there, I guess.
Yeah, I think it's going to take a little bit of work. I've heard different stories about how much work it needs, but I know one of the big things is they really want to try to get a restaurant down there. Either there or one of the other buildings. And they have a restaurant there. Maybe they can attract more people, start to walk downtown. And they do have the police garage, which is almost finished. That's going to get more police presence down there, and you'll have more maybe that'll make people feel safer as well.
That's great. Well, finally, Ed, if you will, talk about the story that you had in there, a very interesting situation, sad situation in a way, for the Lake Ridge School Corporation. They've been doing their best to try to make some major improvements at the Calumet New Tech High School, and now it turns out that it's ended up being clouded by a lawsuit, and it may involve some people from outside the nation.
Yeah, that's what I... unfortunately, there was a case where they had a... an agreement, at least the lawsuit contends, they had an agreement where they would go through certain procedures when they drew down the $7 million in bonds that was mainly designated for the athletic complex at the high school. And the person, I think the business manager, was on vacation at this point, and somehow her, from what I understand from the Lake Ridge school's attorney, her email somehow got hijacked, and they believe it came from someone from some outside the country. And we know we always, you and everybody else always sees these scams from people asking for money. And evidently this one took an old pay voucher or pay affidavit and tweaked it slightly so it looked the same, made some adjustments in it, and then submitted it for a payment. And the school district said, well, you know, in the lawsuit claims, well, they should have known, the bank or the trust should have known that this was fake and shouldn't have paid it out. The trust company has claimed that, you know, we weren't negligent. But whatever's the case, $112,000 evidently got paid out to this this crooks, I guess, basically, that from out of the country, and from very little chance of recovering the money since it is out of the country. At least that's what my understanding is.
Well, let's hope that there might be some remedy that'll come about here. Like I say, it may not be much, if it is any, I suppose. But at least the Lake Ridge schools are doing what they can, and that's tough because it's they're not exactly a very prosperous school district. They're doing their best to keep an eye on the money that they have available, and they certainly don't want to have to give it up to some country, some foreign interest that's decided to poke them. And it's these things happen. I suppose you do the best you can.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the superintendent at first was a little reluctant to talk about it, but I think in the end she said, you know, this is a way for us to warn as well, when the news came out, as a way to warn other school districts and others to look out for these types of scams.
Yeah, good point.
And I think that was a good point. And hopefully they'll be able to get make some type of a resolution, because they, like, as you were saying, they have a lot of other needs that they can use that money for.
That's true. That's true. Ed Bereshenka is reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana. And as always, Ed, thanks for being with us today to talk about the stories that you'd be able to share online and in print as well, too. On this Reporters Roundtable Thursday, let's take a look at education news here across Northwest Indiana. And for that, we're going to turn to Meredith Colias, who is an education reporter for the Post-Tribune. Meredith, thank you for being with us again.
Thank you, sir. Thanks for having me.
Well, you have some great stories this week, and one of them is not only recently just even shown up in the paper as well as online. But let's take first here the story that you had about looking at the latest school accountability grades, as the word came out.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is something that came out earlier this month. The state released accountability grades for all school districts, or most school districts, I should say, in the region, public, private, charter, specifically. When you look as a whole, not much movement from last year. You know, a few grades, a few schools here and there had grades that improved. A few had grades that dropped. Overall, what we're looking at here is just kind of pretty steady.
Mm-hmm. I know that there was one that came out here. It was in another story that I happened to notice here, that the fact that efforts have been made to improve the grades in the Maryville Community Schools, and the intermediate school managed to pick up a nice jump in grades for the good. And it's always the case, I guess, that you're hoping as a school superintendent that what you're doing is going to make a big difference. And at least if you do consistently good things and make consistently good changes, that the grades will go up now. So I'm sure this has to be at least some consolation for all the school districts that have worked very hard, and we know that the probably the toughest of all is having to deal with these bad grades when they come up in the Gary Community Schools. I know that your story took a look at all of the accountability grades, but it's particularly difficult, I'm sure, in Gary right now.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, these grades come out periodically. They're obviously something that schools pay a lot of attention to. The Gary Public Schools obviously is someone that are kind of an entity that is very much paying attention to this. Last year, of course, they were the only district in the state that received a district-wide F rating. This year, of course, because of Senate Bill 567 that passed the legislature, the state has ordered a takeover of the schools, both financial and academics. And so this year, actually, Gary was not part of these rating systems. The state is still reviewing their data. We reached out to Peggy Hinckley, who's now the emergency manager of Gary Schools, and mm-hmm. she said that that's not something that she requested. It looks like it's kind of a routine, review on the part of the state, that they're just looking to see that all the data is correct for all 12 schools in Gary. that they're sort of crossing T's and dotting I's and making sure that it's the most accurate grade that they have for these schools.
I suppose in this case with the Gary Community School Corporation, because they have not only the financial issues, but they have the educational issues they still have to deal with, that Dr. Hinckley and her crew are pretty much focused on dealing with money matters right now, although they know that they have to spend some time dealing with making the changes that will be necessary to help improve the grades overall, I would think.
Yeah, and that's absolutely part of their mandate. They're looking at both right now. Obviously, from a layman's perspective, the financial issues are huge in Gary. You have a district that has $108 million in debt, is, you know, bleeding $1.8 million each month, you know, is not collecting the property taxes that it needs to make the district sustainable long-term. But as you mentioned, too, it's also been a school district that, while it does have some bright points and innovations, you know, absolutely, but overall as a whole, it's a district that's been academically troubled for some time.
I know when you talk here also, too, and it's in one of your stories as well, too, that the Dr. Hinckley, in her visits to the Indianapolis, to the Distress Unit Appeals Board in Indianapolis, talked about some plans that she has in mind in improving the Marquette and Beveridge Elementary Schools. You brought that up in a recent story as well, too.
Yes, absolutely. And these are schools that have struggled for quite a few years, 5 or 6 years or so that these schools have received F ratings from the state. And this is something that, if you're looking at the academic health of the Gary Community School District at this point, this is something that you really want to take a look at. Dr. Hinckley went down to Indianapolis very recently. This was her presentation to the State Board of Education. And really, she's been on the job since August, and this is really one of her first sort of public steps and comments on what is she going to do, what's her plan to turn around schools that have struggled for some time. With these particular schools, what you're seeing, and her whole team was down there, you know, what you're seeing too is that they went in there and sort of evaluated the situation. You know, what they're finding is a couple of things that are systematic problems, that are systemic problems over there. They're finding there needs to be sort of changes in sort of instructional leadership over the years. They're finding that teaching that needs to sort of be improved over there. There's also issues like they haven't replaced books in some time, and that's something that her team is working on getting over there as well. So it's sort of a top-to-bottom process that they're looking at.
Well, finally, Meredith, here, the headline reads, "Students don't feel safe." And that certainly would get one's attention when you're looking at the story, the one that's just come out recently here about concerns that the folks in the Lake Central School Corporation have, and primarily students have concerns, and they've had to bring it up with some of the teachers and other staff members about us. And that story just came out in today's paper, actually. Tell us a little about that, please.
Sure. This is something that we've been monitoring for a few days here at the paper. There were rumors over the weekend that there was a potential protest that was going to be happening at Lake Central sometime this week. It doesn't look like that happened. On Monday, sort of high school staff and administrators sort of put out the message to students that, you know, if they have grievances or just something that they want to talk about, you know, come talk to them during the day. Sean Begley, who is the principal over at Lake Central, put out a email to parents earlier this week saying about 30 students came and talked to administrators.
Mm-hmm.
We're sort of looking at specifics, but generally from the letter that was sent out, what we're learning is that students were coming to administrators, and it was things that they were talking about. Like, there were instances of graffiti, possibly, of social media posts, of things that were potentially insensitive. And so the school district has felt like this was somewhat of a constructive conversation, and they're sort of sitting back and evaluating what they need to do. And you hear this very commonly. There was somewhat of a similar situation about a year ago, back in December, at Indrain High School, where there was a very very specific you know, graffiti that was discovered, and it led to some very serious conversations between the principal and parents there. Many schools are coming out and saying, you know, that they want to make sure, basically, that, especially for African-American students, that when they come to high school, that they want it to be a safe environment, that they want it to be welcoming.
That sounds good. Well, we'll be keeping an eye on that story, as you two, too, and get the information in on this as well, too. We've been talking with Meredith Kolias, who covers educational topics for the Post-Tribune. As always, Meredith, thank you for being with us, and hope to have you back on again soon.
Thank you for having me.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. It's our Reporter Roundtable Thursday. I'm Chris Nolte, and now let's take a look at business news across the region. In recent days, it's time to turn to Joseph Pete, who is the reporter who covers business for the Times of Northwest Indiana. And as always, Joseph, thanks for being with us.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
Let's start out here talking about one of the most recent stories you have out there, a little a warning, I suppose, from the folks at First Source Bank.
Yes. First Source is reporting there have been a swath of texts or a number of texts sent across like a swath of like northern Indiana where it's claiming to be from First Source Bank and to, you know, call this 312 number. They're a South Bend-based bank. They have a ton of locations in Porter and LaPorte counties. They're warning this is a scam. Do not their customer service number is a 574 number. If you have any issues with them, call 574-235-2000. That's their number, and they are they're worried that this scammers are kind of trading in on their name because they're a very large, reputable bank, one of the largest in northern Indiana, mm-hmm. and they are not they're not reaching anybody saying that their attention is needed.
So is it turning out here now that I guess that not only are they have the concern here about the scammers using this opportunity to get into get people's, maybe not necessarily people's accounts, but certainly to try and get some information out of them that they didn't particularly want them to have, I guess.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, this is becoming more and more common. This type of fraud, people will pretend to be from like a company like the bank or Amazon or Google or whoever, and say that they, you know, try to get you to give up personal information on the phone that they will in turn use to steal. They'll say your account is locked or whatever. They'll claim to be any one of these number of popular sites, mm-hmm. and then they'll in turn use that information to steal your identity and potentially like take out a fraudulent line of credit or something of that. And it's becoming an increasing threat that we need to be wary of in our society.
Let's take up a couple of the, we'll take up the first of two, I should say, stories involving the steel industry that you had posted online and in the latest print editions of the Times. Let's take up here the question here about U.S. Steel and where they stand as far as the nation's steelmakers these days.
Yeah, yes, we took a look again. They've been in second pretty much since I think like 2010. They were the company. They're the first billion-dollar corporation in the world. They made 67% of the world's steel. They were the largest steelmaking conglomerate in the United States by far. The old Southworks in Chicago was long the biggest steel mill in the world. Gary Works was then long the biggest steel mill in the world. But they have fallen off and fallen behind. Compared to the mini mills, Nucor, which operates a lot of the mini mills that process scrap in the South, you know, they eclipsed U.S. Steel back in 2010, and it just seems to be like they're sliding further. Nucor shipped about nearly 7 million tons of steel in the second quarter. It was up about 4.5%. U.S. Steel was kind of flat at about 3.8 million tons. It seems to be losing more and more ground. Some of the steel workers I know are pointing out, well, you know, it's not entirely... you have to look at we're looking at just domestic steel makers, but there is a big difference. U.S. Steel does make iron, which Nucor does not do, mm-hmm. and the iron is used in turn to make, you know, car parts and appliance parts that Nucor doesn't make the grade of steel that, you know, is capable of, like, withstanding an impact at, like, 50 miles an hour for a door frame.
Right.
Like, Nucor is making cheap rebar for construction, and so while they both make steel, they both make completely different types of steel, and U.S. Steel remains, you know, it's not as big as ArcelorMittal, but that's, you know, based in Luxembourg.
I know that when Nucor Steel started to become more prevalent in the Midwest, they made sure that people knew about that, and I know the Steelworkers Union definitely did, that they mentioned about the fact that they're two different companies. They still, I guess, they have the word steel in their names, but that doesn't necessarily mean they make exactly the same products to begin with.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. They're making the lower grade steel for mainly for construction projects.
Right.
Of course, a lot of that used to be made at like Gary Works and everything, and they kind of stole that business away from us. But it's like it's lower margin, and a lot of those jobs aren't very secure. Nucor is known for not being unionized, and then part of their model is that they will, you know, when times are good, they'll bring in a lot of people to their mills, and they'll, you know, they'll be running up production, but then they just lay them all off when it's a down period. So they really are cyclical and adjust a lot to the current market demand. And then right now, actually, because the auto industry is still doing relatively well, it was it's fallen off a little bit, but it was a record level. Auto industry steelmaking capacity utilization analysts are telling me are around like 80 to 90% for a lot of the big integrated mills like those we have in Northwest Indiana. And the mini mills right now, it's down. It's around like 60% or so. You just don't have as much construction and infrastructure spending going on right now.
One of the other stories that you had dealing with the steel industry that you had online and in print this week, Joseph, I know, was taking literally a global look at the steel industry. And I guess this new study that came out by the World Steel Association, tell us how the study has shaped up as far as how the steel industry is doing, dealing not only with business, but also with trying to be good environmental stewards.
Yes, a big focus for the steel industry in recent years has been on sustainability, partly because of environmental concerns, but there's also, they also look at other things like workplace safety and things of that nature. But the economic sustainability of the industry, this is something the World Trade Organization has been looking at. It took like a multifaceted survey of its people. It's finding that there have been some gains on the environmental front. Obviously the steel industry doesn't, they burn coal in the blast furnaces. It doesn't necessarily have the best reputation for environmental stewardship, but it's one thing that they've really been prioritizing. You can go to ArcelorMittal R&D in East Chicago, for instance. They've restored tons of dune and swale, natural habitat around there. It's something they're looking at more. They found that greenhouse gas emissions are kind of steady over the last few years. However, the steel industry is generally getting more energy efficient. It's using less energy per ton of steel cast, which will ultimately be better for emissions and greenhouse gases. And they are the environmental management systems are more prevalent now, and then they're doing a better job of converting raw materials into steel, so there's less waste. And those are some areas in which the study found some progress. But then they've also found, there's been steelmakers have generally given workers more time for training, for safety, average of like 7 days worldwide per year last year, up from 6.4 days, just a couple years ago. Injuries are down pretty significantly from 1.4 per million 2014 down to just 1 per million last year. So they're using this as kind of benchmarks and kind of that steelmakers can use for best practices and just looking at different ways they can steelmakers can be socially responsible partners, but also ensure their own, sustainability in the long term. Because a lot of this, if they don't address it themselves, regular governments will step in and regulators will address these things for them. So they have to be proactive about, addressing these matters.
I know in the time that you've spent covering the steel industry here in Northwest Indiana for the Times, a lot of the stories have come out, of course, mainly are dealing with business and how the business is doing these days. And this the sustainability report is interesting, too. It kind of brings back to mind the fact that there's still problems dealing with the environment that come about from the steel industry. And one doesn't have to go back all that many years to remember what was referred to as Easter Day's pile, which was basically a big pile of not pleasant material that was stacked up outside one of the steel mills here in Northwest Indiana. And the investigation into that also led to some problems that dealt with the Indiana Department of Environmental Management and how permits are handed out. So the issues of environmental problems are still going on. And do you note of any, although you don't keep a track on a daily basis, obviously, do you note of any problems that have come to your attention? To bring up these questions about it, not only sustainability, but also about whether the pollution problems in Northwest Indiana are going away.
Oh, sure. Well, it's significantly better than it is. U.S. Steel did have that discharge recently into Lake Michigan from Burns Harbor after an equipment malfunction, but it generally found it was within safe limits. There are concerns because that's obviously a source of drinking water for millions of people. Then the biggest environmental issue lately has been with a supplier, the Indiana Coke Company at ArcelorMittal Indiana Harbor. They provide the coke that's burned in the blast furnaces there. There have been environmental groups have been concerned about the permit, the permit renewal process, they're actually looking at suing EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt because they petitioned to him to intervene with IDEM's permit, and they didn't respond one way or another within 60 days, which they're statutorily required to do so. They have concerns about what's allowed and what's not allowed in the permit. They kind of want like a full accounting because the company has had some issues. They were cited by the EPA on seven different instances, I believe, over the past 6 or 7 years. They repeatedly had problems where their emissions were exceeding, you know, the limits that were allowed. Often it was like a door had popped open or that type of thing. But there were, with their kind of troubled track record, the Southeast Side Environmental Group out of Hagewisch there and some other local environmentalists were hoping that this permit would be an opportunity to kind of get them to tighten their operations. They're the Coke supplier.
Joseph, one last story that you had a chance to give us here for the Times this week deals with the continuing drama about Jeff Bezos and Amazon, about the efforts, I guess nationwide efforts to be the city or the area at least that Amazon will locate HQ2, as they like to call it. I think that's the name of the project now. The second world headquarters for Amazon that would be someplace outside of the West Coast. Tell us about the latest efforts by Northwest Indiana community members and businesses and government officials to try to get Jeff's attention to have them locate the platform. I happen to locate that particular site right here, and there's certainly plenty of room that he could do it.
Oh, yes. Yeah, everybody is chasing this project. It's like Toledo I saw recently put in a bid. They might be considered a little small for it, but like us, they're just outside like a bigger city, like they're outside Detroit. The Northwest, cities all over the country are chasing this, and in reality, it's probably, you know, there are only probably a few legitimate contenders, you know, like Chicago, Boston, Austin, Toronto, cities of that like size and stature. Because mm-hmm. The one thing they need is tech workers. Like above all, it doesn't really matter how many tax breaks you throw at them. They need a huge workforce of skilled tech workers, and then the executives are going to want to live in places with a lot of amenities. And there are just those considerations. So the everybody's chasing this, but the actual list of candidates is probably extremely narrow. That's not to say there isn't value in chasing it, because someone has pointed out recently, this is not the last time Amazon is going to make a location decision. You want to get in front of Amazon. They're going to build warehouses everywhere. They're going to build retail. You want to, you know, make them aware of your community and what assets it has. In Northwest Indiana, the Forum and Gary has assembled a list of like local CEOs and college presidents and so on that are kind of spearheading the bid. It's looking at sites in Gary and other locations. Gary also launched a petition on moveon.org mm-hmm. to try and convince Jeff Bezos that way. They're close to like 1,000 signatures now. It's a lot of these, there have been a lot of gimmicky things that the media has seized on nationally, like Tucson sent a cactus, but that's not necessarily bad. You're getting like free press, and what economic development is really all about is trying to convince like as wide an audience as possible of advantages to investing in your community. So, you know, realistically, nowhere. Amazon probably won't go anywhere in Indiana from the Ohio River to Lake Michigan. It's just workforce, office market, like we're just not built for like a corporate headquarters of this scale. However, there's a benefit to kind of chasing these things because it's, you know, you could potentially bring an Amazon warehouse down the line. You could make some other executive somewhere else. We'll read the ad in the New York Times that Gary took out and realize, oh, this might be a great place for my factory. Like there are definite benefits toward chasing this. The city has put forward another pitch, you know, saying that it's stressing all of its, you know, assets, the National Lakeshore, historic architecture, a Big Ten university. A lot of it seems to hinge upon our proximity to Chicago, which would have the workforce to kind of satisfy the requirements. And you know, Gary's saying, oh, we're only like 35 minutes on the South Shore line.
Right.
And then affordable real estate. The one huge advantage Gary does have now and going forward is it has a lot of, for businesses, is it has a lot of affordable real estate that they could put to use however they wanted.
Now, since this all came out here, you've had a chance in doing the work on your stories to bring maybe to mind and remind people about some of the opportunities that Northwest Indiana does have. We don't have quite the extensive commercial property availability that some communities may have, but it does bring to mind about the fact that we do have some available, and some changes, of course, have come about, too. You mentioned about the 2016 study that the Maryville Company Commercial Sites had done recently looking at industrial Northwest Indiana properties and what was available, but that was an old study, and we know that things have changed here in recent months, and there may be more commercial property might be available. So even if Amazon doesn't happen to take advantage of it, somebody else should.
Oh, absolutely. Well, yeah, one issue with, as far as Indiana and Amazon is that they are looking to build a huge headquarters. They're saying they're going to need 8.1 million square feet and then up to 50,000 workers. But, like, the way they did it in Seattle, you know, they built headquarters, but now they're in 36 different high-rises in the cities. Seattle has, like, a huge central business district. As they continue to grow, they will continue to add, space. There was, I saw where there's a new skyscraper going up there that's, like, 50 stories or something, and then there's, you know, condos. It's like one of those mixed ones, but then basically all Amazon is leasing all the office space in it, and then you just don't have skyscrapers like that anywhere in Indiana, not just here, but Indianapolis. Like, one of their 10th tallest building is like an air traffic control tower. They just don't have, their central business district just isn't large enough for a project of like the scale. They're like 36, when you're talking about, like, you have a headquarters that's so large it's in 36 different skyscrapers, you're looking at like Chicago, you're looking at Dallas, you're looking at like a city like Houston, like that's built for like big corporate business. Like, it's, because the problem is, like, once they outgrow their initial building, they're going to need to start leasing space in other offices. And then, like, Facebook is doing that in San Francisco now. They built a huge headquarters out in Silicon Valley, but they're still renting a bunch of skyscrapers in downtown San Francisco because they just continue to grow and they continue to add people. And it's just, we just don't really have the infrastructure of that type here in Indiana anywhere in the state. And it's, still, you have to, like, you know, take yourself, there's an element of civic pride to this. And then by presenting yourself as a contender to this, you're potentially opening up, you know, other opportunities, especially with, like, warehouses from Amazon, things of that nature. Right. But then other, you know, just other executives, it might intrigue them in, you know, investing here in Northwest Indiana.
Well, certainly, with all the people that are certainly involved with this steering committee that has been created here in the recent weeks, trying to get Amazon's bid to be a serious one in Northwest Indiana. You looked at the list of more than 60 people that are on it. It's literally a who's who list of the movers and shakers in Northwest Indiana, and we're talking about from all facets of life here in the region.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. We have the presidents of Purdue Northwest, I was going to say Purdue Cal, and IUN. We've got the CEOs of, like, Methodist Healthcare and the casinos. We've got prominent lawyers like Cal Bellamy. We've got a number of Gary City officials. This is a serious effort that they're making. It's just, it's a highly competitive situation. You have more than 100 people at it. And then there are questions, even if you do win it, is it ultimately worth it? Because there will be, it's expected to require billions in tax breaks, and then they might never, they're only up to 40,000 people actually at their headquarters in Seattle, and they're saying they're going to create, 50,000 jobs, but the company has been around for, it's taken them decades to get up to like 40,000 workers. So these numbers are just like projections. You don't know how many people they're actually going to end up hiring. You don't know how much they're actually going to invest. The tax breaks could be such that it offsets any, you know, actual benefits to the municipality, at least. Obviously, there'd be a huge economic benefit, but there is, this is an all-in effort, it seems, from Northwest Indiana. You have various, like, the, you know, CEO of the Urban League of Northwest Indiana. You have a bunch of developers, people with catering companies. It's a pretty, people with local banks. It's a pretty impressive list. It's even attracted support from the area. The mayor of South Bend is part of it. Obviously, they would benefit. They would be kind of too far out and too small to, like, qualify by themselves. But because this is one of those projects that's it's so large, it would have ramifications for all of Northwest Indiana if it were to ever, you know, get built here. Because it's just, it would just be a major economic driver. More companies would follow and invest. The amount of spending power the employees would have would be huge. It would mean big opportunities for like smaller businesses, restaurants, coffee shops, entertainment, things of that nature. It was the housing market. Housing is pretty much unaffordable in Seattle now, is my understanding, largely because of Amazon, and it would have a similar effect wherever it happens to locate. Some markets are bigger and easier, will be able to more easily absorb, 50, but they're talking about like 50,000 people at like six-figure salaries.
Wow.
So that would have a dramatic impact on everything from home prices to commercial real estate.
We know for sure that there, as the old saying goes, there's no such thing as bad publicity. So regardless of what happens in all of this, the efforts will still continue to attract more businesses and more people into Northwest Indiana and increase the quality of life here in the region. So whatever efforts are made certainly can't be bad. Look at it that way, too. So we'll certainly get more information to come out of this effort by Amazon to look for a new second headquarters home and how Northwest Indiana is going to stay in the fray as long as they can, I'm sure, to be able to be competitive in that bid for attracting that business. We've been talking with Joseph Pete, who's the business reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana. And as always, Joseph, thanks for being with us today.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
The South Shore Line's double-tracking project got some positive comments yesterday from Miller Beach area residents who attended the first of two public hearings on the federally mandated environmental assessment. Times reported about 50 people were at the opening of the two-hour public session in Miller, and more filed through as the evening went on. Eric Reeves, who's the vice president of the Miller Citizens Corporation, noted to those attending of the group's efforts to try to keep a train station, a commuter train station in particular, in Miller. And now they put their support behind the project as a catalyst for what is known as transit-oriented development. Double tracking project, of course, would extend from Virginia Street in Gary to East Michigan Boulevard in Michigan City. And that about 17 miles of that 27-mile stretch are basically down to single tracks. A new station in Miller is also in the project, and that would be a station where two platforms would be built that would be level to the train doors, as well as an increase in parking spaces from the current 248 to 596 spaces. Other stations along the route are targeted for upgrades as well in the project, and they include Ogden Dunes, Dune Park, Beverly Shores, and 11th Street. The other South Shore Line public meeting, other than the one last night in Miller, is going to be this evening starting at 6 o'clock. It'll be held in Michigan City at the Stardust Event Center, which is located, of course, at the Blue Chip Casino. In the meantime, the rail expansion project, not only the double tracking, but also the Westlake project, under the microscope by Indiana U.S. Senator Todd Young. This $900 million project would, of course, extend the existing corridor of the South Shore Line south to Dyer, and then the double-tracking project between Gary and Michigan City. But the project is reportedly on the chopping block because of a stipulation that was laid out in the president's tax reform framework. Senator Young says that President Trump's proposed budget would eliminate the funding stream that the local officials were hoping to rely on for funding the project. And while they're doing their best to keep that funding stream open, Young told Inside Indiana Business that he is pursuing some alternate sources of funding and working with the rest of the Indiana congressional delegation.
You know, I'm cautiously optimistic. There are a lot of senators, there are a lot of legislators that are pushing for various projects. Right now we need to get through tax reform so we can start growing the economy at a faster rate.
Northwest Indiana Regional Development Authority CEO Bill Hanna believes that there is excellent progress being made on the talks on funding for the South Shore project. And that's because of the recent visits to South Bend from U.S. Transportation Secretary Elaine Chao and the discussions between Governor Eric Holcomb and Vice President Mike Pence. And can't discount the short conversation that Senator Young had on Air Force One with President Trump as he was coming back to his visit in Indiana recently. And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today and for this week. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for joining us. And thank you to our participants in the Reporters Roundtable Thursday from the Times of Northwest Indiana, Ed Bearshank and Joseph Pete, and from the Post Tribune, Meredith Colias. And thanks for being with us. We'll be back with you on Monday.